From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, new discoveries in space with an astronomer from the Vatican. And well, as I announced a few weeks ago, and we're going to post this now on the coasttocoastam.com website tomorrow so you can vote. Our congratulations to Art Bell. He's been nominated to the National Radio Hall of Fame. Now, he's one of the four finalists in the category of National Pioneer. Starting tomorrow, you can cast your vote for Art online. We'll have a direct link for you when you go to coasttocoastam.com, and I hope all of you will cast your vote for Art Bell, National Pioneer. Some of the stories of the day, thanks to Whitley Strieber, unknowncountry.com, passing on this story, saying that we already know that plastic baby bottles are dangerous for boys. They affect them. Now, Canada says that the same kind of plastic known as BPA is poisonous for everyone. The Canadian government about to declare it's a toxic chemical widely used in plastics that we use for eating and drinking. That BPA, which is used in plastics for baby bottles, drink and food containers, and the linings of food cans, no more. It's poisonous, they say. We're going to follow up on that story on a future Coast to Coast program. A U.S. surfer has been killed in a shark attack off Mexico's southern Pacific coast. Just a week ago, we talked about the case in San Diego where a swimmer was bitten by a shark and died. This San Francisco man bled to death after a gray shark bit his right thigh, leaving a 15-inch wound. Just what is happening with animals and creatures? They're attacking humans like crazy. They're biting them. They're eating them. There's something strange going on here. I think in a moment we're going to be talking to an expert on animals and get his take on this. Late President Dwight D. Eisenhower overruled some of his military commanders in the summer of 1958, ordering them not to use nuclear weapons against China if communist forces blockaded the Taiwan Strait. Now, this according to declassified Air Force documents. Eisenhower made it clear that Chinese should be given a warning with conventional explosives before he'd authorize the dropping of the A-bomb on Chinese territories. The president had the support of a congressional resolution to use force in defense of Taiwan. Well, the Federal Reserve, whoever they may be, lowered a key interest rate for the seventh time since last September when a crumbling housing market began spilling over into the broader economy, creating fears of a recession. The Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, and members of the Federal Open Market Committee hinted that this 0.25 cut of the Fed funds will probably be it for a while. And they said they were just very aggressive in their way to try to energize a dormant U.S. economy. It did not work. Albert Hofmann, do you know his name? Probably not. The father of the mind-altering drug LSD, whose medical discovery inspired millions in the 1960s, the hippie generation, as they are called. Well, he's died. He was 102 years old. For decades, after LSD was banned in the late 1960s, Hofmann defended his invention. That's what he said. I produced the substance as a medicine. It's not my fault if people abused it. The Swiss chemist discovered LSD in 1938 while studying the medicinal uses of a fungus found on wheat and other grains. He became the very first human guinea pig of the drug when a tiny amount of the substance somehow seeped onto his finger during a laboratory experiment in 1943. I had to leave work, he said, had to go home. I felt suddenly dizzy, but I got to tell you, I had wonderful visions. Albert Hofmann, the father of LSD, dead at the age of 102. A Vietnamese girl is finally free of a disfiguring 16-pound facial tumor. Can you imagine that? After surgery that lasted at least 12 hours in Miami, the tumor had consumed the lower half of a 15-year-old's face. It had been growing since she was three and eventually accounted for roughly one-third of her body weight. When an Ohio woman looked at an ultrasound, she expected to see a developing fetus. Instead, what she saw, well, she thinks the image of Jesus. Monette Sledge from Lorain, Ohio, got an ultrasound in preparation for her first baby and was shocked when she saw what appeared to be an image of Christ on the cross. We've got that for you at coasttocoastam.com. In Estonia, Police were shocked after stopping a car in a city center, finding that the driver was not only drunk, but blind. Apparently, while he was driving, he was taking directions by a pal who was sitting in the passenger seat, telling this guy, turn right, turn left, go straight. But they got them both. Now, in a moment, as I mentioned, animals around the country, around the world, are going nuts these days. Why? They're biting people, eating people. Something's going on, I think. In a moment, Dr. Randall Lockwood joins us. We'll talk about this situation. Later on, we'll open up your phone call lines. Perhaps you've got a story or two to share with us about some very strange animals as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Randall Lockwood, Senior Vice President for the ASPCA and has a doctorate in psychology from Washington University in St. Louis, not too far from where I am. He studied the behavior between humans and animals for the past 30 years. He's worked with humane societies and law enforcement agencies, serving as an expert on the interactions between people and animals. And he has testified in numerous trials involving cruelty to animals and has spoken to such diverse and prestigious audiences as the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Japanese Animal Welfare Association, and the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He's with us this hour on Coast to Coast. Dr. Randall Lockwood. Randall, how are you?
Very good.
Good. These animal attacks, which include bears, cougars, sharks, seem to me to be happening in higher numbers than the past, unless the media is reporting on it more. What is going on in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, you certainly touched on one of the things that the media is reporting it more, but they're probably are more attacks that there have been in the past, and partly because we're trespassing. We are intruding more and more into wildlife habitat. We are encroaching into areas of wildlife. I live about 9 miles from the White House here in D.C., and we've had a coyote in our neighborhood. I've had deer in my yard, and this is suburbia, as I say. We're just a couple miles from the White House. I had predicted that we'd see coyotes in this area by the end of this decade. I was off by about 5 years. They showed up a couple of years ago. So increasingly, we are encroaching on animal habitat. You know, as far as shark attacks go, like we've had,
they're getting bolder.
Well, you know, we've had, according to the International Shark Attack File, there have been like 1,400 shark attacks in the last century. Almost half of those have been on surfers, but they didn't start showing up until about 1970 because people weren't surfing that much. And, you know, more and more people are heading out into those areas. We actually didn't see reports about shark attacks much at all in the literature until, like, World War II, when we had a lot of downed flyers and sailors sinking ships. And suddenly, you know, shark attacks became big stories and popular stories in the media and so on, because more and more people were in the water. Well, that was usually the end result of air disasters and shipping disasters, and now more and more people are in the water because that's where they're getting their recreation. So, as I said, we're often trespassing more and more. Same is true with encounters with bear, cougars, and so on. Increasingly, we are living in their backyards.
Is it possible also, Dr. Lockwood, that maybe there's a shortage in that animal or that creature's food source? You know, maybe fish in the ocean that sharks would eat, for example, are dying off, or you know, something's happening to them. Is that possible?
Could be part of it, too. But also, you know, one of the things that I know people who've looked into shark attack often talk about, the kinds of behaviors that swimmers and surfers and divers engage in that make them look like popular prey, that you look like a seal or you look like some other preferred prey, and we're about the right size and shape for a lot of predatory species. So it's not just that their own natural food may be less abundant. It's that we're pretty easy prey. I mean, we're basically slower and clumsier than just about anything else that they're going to encounter.
I could not think of a more horrible way to go than to be swimming in the ocean. You can't see what's underneath you. and all of a sudden you get yanked or bitten by a shark. I mean, what a horrible situation.
I think, you know, this is one of the things that grabs our attention, that it does strike you, at a very primal level, the idea of being eaten by a wild creature. That's got to be one of the most basic, you know, mammalian fears of being something's prey, which is why we do get so exorcised about these stories, why we are so concerned about shark attack, bear attack, cougar attack, dog attack. Again, the idea of being prey for another animal is something that our earliest ancestors, I'm sure, had nightmares about over in their caves by their campfire. So it definitely strikes us in that reptilian part of our brain.
I won't swim in the ocean. If I can't see my feet and legs, I'm not going to go in the water. I don't know. It's just a strange feeling.
Yeah, and again, I think it's like one of those primal fears, like, you know, fear of falling and all the stuff that was a danger to our ancestors. It still strikes us as scary. And it's one of the basic fears when you look at some of the psychology studies of young children's nightmares. Very often they are about bears, and even kids have never really seen them, and they hear friendly stories of in kids' books, but again, it's one of these primal fears.
You know, the university you went to, which I know very well, it's not too far from where I am, excellent college, puts out some of the greatest minds, I think, in this country. You're one of them. We just had an earthquake a few weeks ago in this region in Washington. You got part of it. I mean, they didn't have any damage, but I mean, they were right there. Animal behavior is also something I want to talk with you about tonight, Randall. I mean, they pick up on earthquakes before they occur. The animals, for example, in that horrible Indonesian tsunami, they picked up on it and they took off for the highlands. What's going on? How do animals pick up on stuff like that?
I actually did write an article on that for a weather catalog, a weather calendar last year, and particularly looking at some of the things. One of the interesting things was when people went in to survey the damage after the tsunami, and one of the major areas affected was a large national park area in Sri Lanka and also on some of the other islands, and they found no dead animals. Most of the animals, the elephants and other native wildlife, had gone to high ground well in advance. And particularly, there were lots of stories, even among some of the loggers that made use of working elephants, where several minutes before the tsunami struck, the elephants had actually taken their drivers, their mahouts, to higher ground. Well, we know that elephants, for example, communicate using very, very low frequencies, which are not unlike some of the subsonic sounds that would occur with the early trembles associated with the earthquakes. So it's part of their repertoire to be able to hear those kinds of noises that would be predictive. You know, I don't think we necessarily have to think about any kind of magical sixth sense, that there are very real senses that a lot of animals make use of, detecting changes in electrical fields. That's one way they can detect prey, detecting sounds at very low or very high frequency, detecting changes in magnetic orientation. You know, so many animals navigate by that, and there might be magnetic shifts when there are changes. We know animals are very good at relatively short-term prediction of major storms. And again, you know, I deal a lot with dog behavior problems. A very common dog behavior problem is thunderstorm phobia. And usually they start showing signs of anxiety before the storm even shows up, because there are changes in air pressure and maybe distant thunder that alert them. And you think back, well, their ancestors, the wolf that knew enough to get out of the rain and to get in the cave before the lightning came, was going to be in better shape and more likely to survive.
Got a call yesterday during one of our open line segments of a person who was telling us about an autistic child. And he said that this autistic child picked up on the earthquake in the St. Louis area before it occurred. And then apparently in the school where they had several autistic children, they all apparently picked up on it before it occurred. Now, how could that be? Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, part of our the process of becoming civilized and becoming socialized is learning to tune out the distractions that might be very important, and that's certainly something that animals can do, and you know, people have just learned to shield out that stuff. If you were constantly tuned into changes in air pressure and so on, it could be quite annoying. I have to be very sensitive to pressure changes, and can usually tell when a storm's coming, and it's actually kind of a pain because it's distracting, and you know, in some way it could be seen as a useful talent. In other ways, that it interferes with getting on with the work you got to do.
I think so too. In some of the work that you do with the ASPCA, what are some of the new things the group is doing?
Well, one of our latest initiatives is we have launched our veterinary forensics program. We actually have really the first animal CSI unit. We have a mobile vehicle that it's based in Atlanta, but we travel around helping police and others investigate crime scenes involving animals using some of the techniques that's being used in human CSI work. And just 2 weeks ago, we had the world's first international conference on veterinary forensics, bringing together experts in the kinds of things you see on CSI, on blood spatter and DNA work and so on, applying these to crimes involving animals. And our team has worked on a number of high-profile cases, including the Michael Vick case.
Well, we're going to take some calls in a half hour for you, and I'd like people to relate some of their incredible animal stories for us if we can. Now, lately, across the country, we're also hearing cases of animal abuse. A horse has been abused 3 times. I constantly see stories of people abusing dogs and cats. Here in the St. Louis area, some young guy strangled a cat. What the heck's wrong with people, Randall?
Well, I think, you know, again, what we're beginning to realize is our common sense notion that people who hurt animals are not nice people, and that we are increasingly recognizing animal cruelty as both a potential predictor of antisocial behavior, crimes against people, but also an indicator that there are other crimes perhaps going on in the family. We often see animal abuse in the context of domestic violence and child abuse, where often one of the things underlying it is the person's need for power and control. That's why they pick on weaker people. That's why they pick on kids. That's why they might abuse their spouses. And some of that power trip is learned at the expense of animals, and that's where some of this link comes in. And again, like the animal attack stuff, the question I get asked a lot is, well, is animal cruelty on the rise, or are we just being more responsive to it? And again, it's probably a little of both. Certainly, we have much stronger laws than we had even a decade ago protecting animals. But also we have more recognition by law enforcement, by police and prosecutors, that these are people who we need to be concerned about. You know, I know in St. Louis recently there was a fairly large-scale dogfight raid, and at almost every dogfight we find, you know, weapons, we find drugs, we find most people picked up at a dogfight convention have outstanding warrants. As the police have learned, this is a good place to catch a lot of bad people.
And what about the little old lady who loves animals, has 150 cats, obviously can't take care of them, but she adores them. I mean, what do we do with her?
That's a totally different psychopathology. That's what we call our animal hoarders. And that's actually, I get about 2 or 3 cases a day crossing my desk from around the country. We actually have a whole task force in New York City associated with the health department just to deal with animal hoarders. And again, this is something that certainly does seem to be on the rise, and we could spend a whole show just on that. And the stereotype is somewhat correct in that more than 2/3 of these situations do involve older women, although we've seen young men, couples. We've seen virtually everything being hoarded, from you know, dogs and cats are the most common, but we've seen goats, lizards, reptiles, horses, just about everything.
So I want to do a full show with you on that, Randall. Stay with us, though. We're going to come right back with your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Dr. and brother Guy Consolmagno joins us. He's a planetary scientist with the Vatican Observatory. We're going to talk with him about some incredible things. That's next hour. But we'll be back with your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. You know, we've also heard about these bizarre animal attacks with death. A lady got harpooned by a stingray. Happened to the crocodile hunter. He died in a freak accident. Those, I guess, Randall, can't be predicted and can't be stopped, correct?
Pretty much. And again, it's you know, more and more people being out there where the animals are. People didn't used to go swimming with stingrays, and you know, we go swimming with sharks, swimming with dolphins. We expose ourselves to those things, and you know, we tend to think that we have tamed nature, and very often we really haven't. And that's something you have, even like in the case of the bear attack. And I've had some friends seriously injured who are very knowledgeable of working with animals, and we get complacent. We think we understand them, and yet, you know, they don't see us the way we necessarily think they see us, and things can change in an instant.
The Siegfried and Roy situation, for example, where some say the tiger was trying to protect him, others say not, but a case where can you really trust an animal who genetically is out in the wild?
Yeah, and I think, and it's interesting that the individual killed in the bear attack, you know, this is a company that very knowledgeable, very careful people in training predators for work in films. And ironically, one of the things they had done was train tigers to film a reenactment of the attack on Roy Horn. So, you know, they knew what they were doing. So it's not unusual to see people who are very knowledgeable still succumb to this, and you know, probably Roy Horn knew tigers better than just about any animal person around, which is one of the reasons why, you know, we so strongly oppose keeping exotics as pets, because the professionals have enough problem with them, and the amateurs are just asking for trouble.
Around the East Coast, we get reports of panthers running loose, big ones. Have they gotten loose from some farm, some animal farm, or are these just myths?
Well, I think what we certainly in the West, we are seeing more mountain lion encounters, and there are more mountain lions from the Rockies on west. In the East, one of the things that looking into lion attacks or lion encounters, mountain lion encounters, cougar encounters, people are pretty bad at judging size and distance, again, because we don't, you know, we're not out there living in the woods. So some of these animals may be lynx, bobcats, or large, even house cats. The list of animals that have been misidentified as cougars, even in cougar attacks, include, you know, dogs, cats, smaller wildcats, things like that. And in some cases, they are escaped or released captive pets. We occasionally, you know, do see released wolf-dog hybrids or even wild wolves that are not native to an area. When you look at a wolf, let's say, that's been shot in some area that seems to be tamer than it should be, there have been DNA studies done showing this is not a wolf that's indigenous to this area. It was obviously somebody's escaped pet.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our west of the Rockies line first of all. You are on Coast to Coast with us. I'll have you, Danny. You're going to have to plug him in. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead. Hello.
Hi, George.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Rob calling from Vancouver.
Go ahead, Rob.
I have thought for years that possibly pollution had an effect on wild animal behavior because, I mean, we see in the paper every day, you know, the issues of air quality, and I thought that maybe, you know, we're toxically poisoning our wild animals. And I'm just kind of curious as to what Randall's take on that is. I'll take
right.
the answer off the air.
Are we doing that, Randall?
I think that's certainly a reasonable hypothesis. We know particularly certain pesticides, you know, some of the organophosphates and things like that, we know do affect behavior and do, for example, one of the effects that I had documented many years ago was even relatively low levels of pesticides will get into the food chain, and the birds of prey that attack the mice and rats and voles that are eating those will accumulate that, and not only does it affect the reproductive behavior, but it can affect levels of aggression. So that's possible. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine wrote a book where he actually was hypothesizing that some of the increase in dog attacks in this mythical story were related to the dogs being exposed to a toxic waste dump, which was actually loosely based on a real case that I had had. So there certainly is a potential connection there.
Next up, let us go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a question, and I wanted to tell you I have rats, a pet domesticated rat, and I absolutely love them. They're very sweet. I rescued one right by the University of Texas, like close to campus. Some of the homeless kids had one out there, and I rescued it and took it. He was almost dead. I had to take him to the emergency room. Anyways, he's very sweet, but they had done horrible things to him, like burned his tail and burned his little toes and everything like that. And so I got a hold of the authorities. I called the police, and there's absolutely no law currently in place for domesticated rats or any kind of rodents. You know, cruelty, as far as cruelty to animals go. And so there was nothing that they could do. And I was just, my question is there anything that I can, you know, do as far as trying to get something passed or any, I wouldn't even know how to go about doing that.
How do you start fighting something like that, Randall?
It's interesting that we've seen, when I got started like 20 years ago looking at this, we only had four states where torturing an animal could have been prosecuted as a serious crime, as a felony offense. As of about 2 weeks ago, with the addition of Hawaii and Utah, we're now up to 44. And almost all of those cases have started with a single animal that was the victim of abuse. And a lot of these laws are named after the animal, usually that was abused by, you know, by teenage boys or younger. And what it takes is this citizen outrage at these cases. Now, the other problem is every state defines animal cruelty differently. Every state even defines animal differently. So some states, torturing a rat that might have been someone's pet or not, still could be seriously prosecuted because some state laws apply to all animals. Some only apply the more serious laws to companion animals. But in some states, what you've described could have been prosecuted. A lot of other states specifically exclude what they would consider to be vermin, and they might have interpreted the rat coming in that way. So if the law does not seem to be addressing serious issues, you know, you take it up with your legislators, you start with your congressman, or if it's a city ordinance, if it's a city council. But that's how these 40 new laws that we've seen just in the last 15 years or so pretty much got started with someone, usually an individual or a group, really upset about something that had happened to a specific animal.
You know, and they do say that a young person who abuses animals like that could end up being a serial killer when he grows up.
Yeah, and I have actually interviewed some serial killers, and we had one caller from Vancouver, and actually Keith Jesperson, who grew up in Canada, in Kamloops, Canada, and then was finally arrested in Oregon. I interviewed him at length, and he, you know, talked about how at 5 or 6 he really got a sense of power and control, killing cats and other animals at his family's trailer park. And, you know, he was one of the first people I ever talked to who really made the connection from point A to point B. He said, you know, after seeing how good this made me feel, I wondered what it would feel like to kill a human being, and I finally did it, and it felt good. I asked him, why do you kill people? He said, well, because it's easy and it makes me feel good.
Well, let me ask you this, Dr. Lockwood. Not all animal abusers end up being serial killers.
Absolutely.
But are all serial killers animal abusers?
Not all, but retrospective studies, it's maybe a third to a half. It's often very hard to get at those records. But we've done studies also interviewing folks. We did a study interviewing 100 prisoners in the Florida State Penitentiary, divided into violent and nonviolent offenders. And about 50% of the violent offenders had childhood histories of repeated acts of violence against
animals.
That's
still high. Yeah.
About 20% of the nonviolent offenders. So, it's high. And one of the interesting things is, about those people that might have had that experience and then didn't go on, what is it that brought them back? And that's another question of a lot of interest, because not all people follow that path. And what is the moment of awakening, realizing I don't want to do that, or finally making that connection? And the common thread, I think, between the animal abusers and a lot of criminals is just a total lack of empathy for other people, other living things. And if we can figure out how to restore that empathy or promote that empathy, that's a very important step.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi. I just wanted I'm a nurse, George. I've taken care of problem patients, and I've also been an animal rescuer, and I find the same thing is true with people as true with animals. I get a report saying this is a difficult person, they're violent, and I go in there with a loving attitude, and these people react to me, and, hey, how'd you do that, Mike, and I tell you, George, I've rescued hawks, coyotes, and...
Good for you.
I'm not an animal hoarder. I don't have 150, but I have a few cats, even though I didn't like them. I got them all fixed. But my take on what's going on is animals react to people because they don't like what people are doing to them. And Noah was a good example. How was he able to hoard all those animals in his ark? And I just want to get your take on that. I think the ocean fish are reacting. They're intelligent creatures. They see what's going on. The purpose is to see what's going on with the sharks. They communicate too. The porpoises are being killed in a lot of our experiments. I'm not a strict environmentalist, but they communicate too. They feel the hurt and the pain. And do you think they're just reacting to people and taking on the attitudes of people in these days to a certain extreme? Let's get rid of road rage.
I do think the animals pick up on that, and I don't know if they're reacting to that or not, Randall.
Well, again, talking about, as when we were talking about the animals predicting the tsunamis and earthquakes and storms, we do tend to forget that the perceptual world of most animals is very different from ours, and it is almost a form of ESP, for example, because dolphins and seals and a lot of marine mammals make use of echolocation. That means they're walking around with their own sonogram machine in their head, and when they're scanning a person standing next to them in a wading pool or swimming among them, they basically can see your heart beating, see your guts churning. They have a lot more information about one another as well as the people in the water with them. They can perceive changes in human physiology that we are totally insensitive to in dealing with one another. And I like to say that most of the dogs I work with are much better observers of human behavior than most humans are of their own dogs. Your dog is watching you, trying to figure out how you're feeling, what you're going to do next, and he's usually a much better predictor of that than you are of what he's going to do.
Carmen in Victoria, British Columbia, you're on the air with us. Hi, Carmen.
How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to let you know about my cat, Fetty. He's always been able, I've had him 10 years, and always a week prior to an earthquake, he's always acted more aggressive, crazy, trying to hide under the furniture, which is only like an inch off the floor. And then always a week later, we've had an earthquake, maybe not a big one, but always a little tremble. And also, he... was always meowing at the ceiling, and my sister took a picture, and she's done this many times now, and always around him are three or four orbs. So I just thought I'd phone and let you know that.
I love that. Do you believe animals have souls like people, Randall?
I have no way of knowing. I think they certainly are, you know, connected to whatever connects everything else, whether they're part of the force or whatever else.
Okay, I'll buy that.
But you know, and interesting talking about cat perception. If you recall, a couple of months ago, the story, and I got involved in the story of the cat in England living in the nursing home. That could predict when people were about to die, that this was the cat that was always found curled up with someone, and they had just learned, well, if they saw the cat with this patient, they would just call the family because this person was not going to be around for more than a few more hours. And actually, one of my own staff people has what she calls her sentinel cat. She does a lot of cat rescue, and she had one cat that unfortunately just died this week, but it used to... If it was curled up with another one of her rescue cats, she knew that cat was about to go into kidney failure or something else. But so that's something that's not at all uncommon. And clearly, you know, these are animals that are picking up on changes that even an experienced vet or physician was not sure exactly what they were cueing in on.
Well, I love stories when people call this program and talk about seeing cat prints or dog prints moving on their bed of their deceased animal. That's just great stuff. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Good morning, George. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
This is Sean calling from Waterbury, Connecticut.
Okay.
I just wanted to share a story with you two guys. We have a there's a court case going on about town over from us where this guy and his son were at his brother's house. And his brother had a pit bull, and I guess the pit bull bit the son. So the guy got upset and took it out on the dog by drilling holes with a drill into the dog's head. And the outcome of the court case was all he's doing is getting deported. And I don't understand why all these animal abusers, a lot of them, don't end up doing any prison time. You know, I mean, I know Michael Vick went to prison, but, you know, I see that a lot of them don't end up going to prison, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, I think what we need to do, and I spend a lot of my time doing workshops for prosecutors into why and how prosecute animal cruelty, and then doing outreach to judges. And some of the problems are that it's not so much the district attorneys, they are taking these cases seriously. The police are taking them seriously. Sometimes the problem is with the judges. Sometimes the problem is actually with the evidence that it just is not quite strong enough to stand up in court, which is why ASPCA has launched our veterinary forensics, our veterinary CSI unit, to help document these cases, to give them the evidence that's going to stand up in court and lead to tougher prison sentences. We've got a pretty good track record that most of the cases that we've testified in, we've gotten some pretty stiff prison sentences. And that is changing. But we still have judges out there that even don't take, you know, child abuse or domestic violence that seriously, and certainly don't take animal cruelty
that's
that
true.
Seriously. And,
that's
but that seems to be changing.
Randall, thank you so much for being on the program. We got to talk about a full show later, okay? Dr. Randall Lockwood. Up next, the Vatican and astronomy on Coast to Coast AM.